Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levypayers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
It's all eyes on ruminant farmers when it comes to environmental improvements, whether you're in England, Scotland, or dare I mention it, Wales. The situation and direction we're being pushed in is the same. We need to produce more from less, we need to minimise emissions, and when I say that, I don't just mean carbon. And we need to think about how much carbon we can absorb in our soils. I'm Steve West, and welcome to this episode of the Food and Farming Podcast, where we'll be scratching the surface of the practicalities and benefits of growing clover. In England, we have the benefit of payments through the Sustainable Farming Incentive for some of these environmentally beneficial practices. And it's clear that some of the options are proving extremely popular, like legume fallows, herbal lays, and birdseed mixes. With engagement rates being so high, are we modifying our farming practices to gain the payments at the expense of production or even profit? And where should we look to make the most of these new tools? I went to see former Nuffield scholar and now organic farmer Will Armitage at his farm at the foot of the hills overlooked by Keythorpe Hall in Leicestershire. I wanted to talk to him about why he integrates clover into his system, why it's so critical to him, and how he's able to do that without some of the tools that are available to the rest of us. As I drove down the drive, it was clear to see how much rain had fallen. It had been a relatively mild winter following one of the wettest years on record. Hello, hello, I'm here to see Will. Yes. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me today, Will. Can you tell us a little bit about Keythorpe Lakes and what it consists of?
Yeah, so Keythorpe Lakes Farm, there's 900 acres and 730 farmable acres. I actually came here as herd manager at the age of 22. And back then, the remit was to have the highest yielding herd of cows in the country and win the Gold Cup, which we managed to do after 6 years of being here. And I was promoted to farm manager at that point. We carried on with the high-yielding cows. Yeah, I guess we were milking three times a day for 11 years. And then the economics started to kick in and the milk price dropped. And so the margins were just getting squeezed all the time.
You don't have a Leicestershire accent. Where have you come from?
I was brought up on Exmoor. Mum and Dad told me that I'd have to chase cows or corn because there was no money on the hills, but brother's doing a pretty good job down there at the moment. I went milking cows, started down on Dartmoor. We did a few shows, and then I really thought that I could be quite good at the showmanship. I set myself a target of winning in the UK and America and Canada, and I was All Britain champion showman in 88, and then I won the Jersey showmanship at the Royal Winter Fair in Canada, and then I won the showmanship in Madison as well. And then that actually built me a profile to move here. Peter Dixon Smith phoned me up and asked me if I'd come and work for him. So that was the thing.
You mentioned the Gold Cup. So 96 and 97, that was, you won the World Cup.
World Cup.
The Gold Cup.
I'll take that one. The Gold Cup, nearly.
So some would say, yeah, that's not a bad milestone. And you've done that with high-yielding cows. How on earth do you get from there to then overhauling the system and going organic?
So I was actually working for Peter Dixon Smith at that time, so I was farm manager.
Right.
We were starting to get disillusioned with the way, maybe the way the Holstein breed was going. Also, the margins were tight. Peter had always said he wanted to sell the herd when he was 70, and then he offered me the farm on an FBT. I didn't have £250,000 worth of ingoings, but he said, I want to do something with you, will you go into partnership? So we went into partnership, and the partnership started in 2004. And with the large landmass that we had, it made sense that we could actually go organic. So we could take a drop in forage yield per acre and hopefully sell, you know, milk with a premium to it, which is what we did. So that was the starting point. It's been a really interesting journey from where we were to where we are now.
So effectively, it was a financial decision why you changed system. Things have been quite tough the last couple of years in the organic sector. You know, people talk about food inflation, but there's all sorts of challenges. How has that been?
Yeah, so it's really been tough the last 4 years, I guess. The organic margin has been eroded. I'm in a discussion group where we do our CFP figures on a six-monthly basis, a budget and an actual. And there was a time, you know, when I would be up in the top quarter. And now, you know, the last sort of 4 years, we've been in the bottom quarter. And it's just that organic margin has been eroded. The costs and how those have increased massively. You know, organic soya has touched £1,000 a tonne. You know, you could say you shouldn't be feeding soya if it's organic. But actually, if you look at the carbon footprint of organic soya, it has a very good carbon footprint because it's small farmers and communities that are growing soya organically, small acreages, and then putting it together and making boatloads or containers of organic soya.
I often hear from conventional farms, if you're going to go organic, you've got to accept a reduction in productivity, certainly increased costs. Does that apply to forage? I mean, would we expect that you're not going to be able to produce as much forage in an organic system?
So in an organic system, you are more weather dependent.
Right.
So the likes of a drought, you know, your soil microbes will dehydrate, and then when the moisture comes back, you know, there is a period when those soil microbes have got to repopulate. Whereas throwing a bag of nitrogen on, you know, you get that growth pretty instantly. But on average, you know, so certainly with the legumes, we can keep up with the conventional boys in terms of yield. And that's, you know, what our contractors would say over the last 17, 18 years of being organic, that actually we're doing as much grass as the conventional guys. And I did have a contract farming agreement where we were using nitrogen. We could out-yield them with good, diverse crops of grass and legumes.
Can you quantify that?
In 2017, you know, we were looking at sort of 14 tonnes dry matter per hectare, which is, you know, which is good. That wouldn't be the average. You know, we can grow a lot of forage.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're that far behind conventional yields.
No.
And actually, if you looked at the integrity of the forage, so actually the mineral concentration of that forage,
yeah,
I would say we would definitely be on par and even maybe a little bit ahead.
Yes.
You know, when you look at the overall mineral concentration of that forage, a lot of people are throwing an awful lot of nitrogen on the ground, mm-hmm, and growing an awful lot of empty calories. You know, when you look at USDA figures for human health, you know, the mineral density of food has dropped by over 40% in America. And then you see all the problems that they've got with obesity and everything else. So we need to be growing high integrity feed.
So you would believe that what's going into the cow is influencing the product that's coming out?
Yeah, definitely. And the overall immune status of the herd.
You know, we talk about sugars, metabolizable energy in grasslands, protein. They'd be on a par, pretty much.
So our MEs would be similar. They wouldn't be quite as high as the conventional guys.
No.
But then how are we measuring it? With NIR, you know, it's a very blunt instrument, or are you using, you know, chemical analysis to analyse your feeds?
Yes. So you would advocate a wet analysis, really, for more of a leafy...
I would. I think NIR has come a long way, probably in the last 6 to 8 years. But there was a time when NIR was hardly worth the paper it was written on because there wasn't enough data behind it. And, you know, it's making too many assumptions. And actually, there's a calculation for the amount of nitrogen and so, therefore, the D-value and the protein. Well, you know, that may be non-protein nitrogen, it's not true protein. And I actually think the protein figures that we get in our organic forage is true protein.
Yeah.
So when we get a high protein forage, you know, the cows do respond, and they do respond really well. In terms of any ME, I think our MEs might be slightly lower because we're taking a little bit longer to grow that grass because we can't grow it with a flush of nitrogen.
Right.
But then what you do, you end up, you rely on your legumes to actually lift your true proteins in the whole forage. So what we get in analysis is a true values rather than estimations of what we get.
I see. Well, you've mentioned legumes. It'd be really great if we can go and have a look at some. Let's go and put our wellies on.
That's it, we'll jump in the truck.
Oh, perfect.
So, yeah. So, yeah, this is grazing platform.
So we've got tracks. You've obviously invested heavily in that.
Yeah, well, the concrete sleeper tracks, yeah, these were put down 20 years ago, I bet. So they were only £2.80 a sleeper. They'll be worth a bit when we actually lift them up, if we have to.
Yes.
Straight away, all the worm casts.
We're a bit squelchy. So you've had a fair bit of water up here?
Yeah, a lot. It's actually walking fairly well, though. Since we've been organic, the land is just... There's just more air in it. It's free of draining. It warms up quicker. We've got a living organism that is actually working for us, which is great.
This pasture, I suppose it's coming up just to the bottom of my calf. So in terms of dry matter, what would we be at here?
2.4, 2.3, 2.4.
So there's a fair bit on. We're quite closed cover. You can't see any soil.
No.
But we can see some white clover leaves.
Yep.
So has that started to motor? What's the...
No, not really. So we last grazed this paddock. It would have been 12th of November, something like that. It was the last paddocks we were in. But no, the clover, it has moved. So it dried up and we got some sunshine about 3 weeks ago and it was starting to move. But we've just had another 3 weeks of wet. So yeah. It's just sat there at the minute.
What is the purpose of clover here at Keythorpe?
It's vital to our system.
Right.
So on the grazing platform, it's rare that we put slurry on the grazing platform.
Right.
Because actually the cows are on here for 8 to 9 months of the year. And the slurry is actually taken off to the silage ground.
Right.
You know, there's no point putting it all in the same place. So it's very rare that we put slurry on the grazing platform. It needs to look after itself. And the clover is a vital part of fixing the nitrogen and working in a synergy with the grass to supply that grass with the nitrogen.
Yeah. Right. So of course, being organic, you're not bringing any onto the farm at all.
Nitrogen. No.
At the Australian Dairy Conference, you quoted, what was that number? Was it?
Yeah, there's 74,000 tonnes of nitrogen above every hectare on the planet because air contains 78% nitrogen. And when we're actually breathing it in, I think it's probably wrong to be turning black carbon or oil into nitrogen and then throwing it around, when actually all we need to be doing is utilising the air and having an aerated soil with the right soil microbes, a healthy breathing soil that can utilise that.
So that nitrogen fixation is the sole reason? Are there other reasons?
There's also palatability mid-season and also protein. You know, the protein percentage in our crops is obviously higher with the clover there.
Right. That's going to be critical to you, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, organic soy has been up to £1,000 a tonne, and, you know, that's an awful lot of money. The higher the protein in the forages, the better, to within reason, because it needs to be in balance in terms of the ME and the protein, or the energy and the protein within the whole ration.
The grazing platform here, these are white clovers. You're not sowing any red clovers in here at all, or?
No, although we've just signed up to, you know, the herbal lays and the SAM 3, so it may be that we do stitch. Because we're high in calcium in the soil, legumes actually like that high calcium. And so we've actually signed up to quite a lot of SAM 3. So right. We will be stitching more into these lays. And actually the legumes, you know, they'll deliver the protein, they'll fix the nitrogen, and they grow, you know, on our high calcium soil. We have used some alcite clover,
right,
which is a clover that the Scandinavians use quite a lot because it tends to get going in a little colder climate. I haven't been over impressed with it. But no. It does play a part.
With respect to reseeds, what's your approach to reseeds? Is it autumn, spring?
So on the grazing platform,
yeah.
So this paddock has now been in 23 years.
Without being lifted?
Without being lifted.
Right.
And, you know, this is one of our best paddocks. And so top yield would be sort of 13 tonnes dry matter per hectare. But annually it'll do between 10 and 12. We had our discussion group come round and I was saying to them,
Come on in, guys. Should reseeding policy, what should I be doing? No, leave this one, leave this one, leave this one. And then we got to the end. And, well, how long they've been down, Will? There's 6 years? No, 23. You know, and actually, these are red circle lays. So they're late heading perennial ryegrasses and clover swards. But okay. With the SAM3, we're going to stitch a bit more into them. We have done some work with chicory and plantain. The chicory doesn't last very long in these heavy soils. The plantain, I think, has got more mileage, but it was very noticeable last spring that actually the slugs were grazing the plantain out,
right,
which was really annoying. I've now got to look for a hairy leaf plantain to stop the slugs from eating the plantain.
So what about leather jackets? So, I mean, I guess if you're not going grass to grass, then you're in a better position, are you?
We have to be very aware of the pests that will be there, but actually it's about checking the life cycle of those pests and when we can do things at the right time. Yeah. You know, it's about timeliness with organic and, well, conventionally, you know, there aren't the horrible sprays that they used to be able to throw around and nuke your soil.
Yes.
You can't do that anymore. If we were taking a paddock out of grass, but there's no reason for us to do that at this moment in time, but if we do, we'll take it out. We'd probably take it out in the autumn. We then grow a cover crop to mobilise some of the mineral into the crop and then plough that down and then grow another crop. And it may be that we go with a completely different crop and go fodder beet or maybe even a whole crop.
Right.
It depends. So we have the field over on the bank under the hall there. That was really bad for docks, and that we inherited that from the previous owner.
Right.
So there was a hell of a lot of docks there. And so what we did, we actually cover cropped it, ploughed the cover crop down, whole cropped it, went again, cover crop, whole crop, cover crop, whole crop. And we actually reduced our dock population by 90%, I guess, 90-95%.
Right.
So docks and stinging nettles will tend to be luxury uptakes of potash. So if you're very high potash, that's where your problems will be.
Right.
And so we were growing the cover crop to mobilise the P and Ks and the mineral to put into the whole crop, and then we were taking that off and feeding it to the Ks.
Gosh.
And then we were and then that muck would be exported to the other areas of the farm. So actually we were depleting the P and K levels in that soil, so there wasn't the luxury uptake of potash, so you didn't get the dock pop, you know, and then you were moving the dock roots as well, so it was a combination of the two.
I can see how that works.
Yeah.
And then when you put the forage in, when you put the grass in,
yeah,
that was a plough, was it?
Yeah, so I'm not afraid of the plough.
No.
And certainly on our soils here, we're heavy clays. And with these heavy clays, you know, you do need air in your soil.
Yeah.
And a lot of this mintil tends to be tamping the top, and you're not actually getting air into your lower profiles. Basically, a thread root on any plant can exert 300 psi, and then as soon as it can't penetrate any further than that, that will be your anaerobic zone. So if you've got a soil that is very tight and compacted,
yes,
you know, the thread roots can't get through, which will mean there's no air or root exudate going into the soil. And so, you know, you have a chance of actually reducing your topsoil. So the plough is a really good reset. You know, you've got to be mindful of how much carbon you're actually losing. So if we plough, we always plough a green manure into it.
Right.
So that the soil microbes can repopulate that soil very, very quickly.
So, and a green manure is effectively, it's a mulched green product that is mobilised,
yeah,
those trace,
yeah,
elements.
So we use oats and fodder radish and winter vetch. Sometimes there'll be some crimson clover in there as a cover crop, but actually the oat is a really good scavenger and it mobilises that mineral out of the soil. Then that green manure has the mineral in a bioavailable form that the next crop can you actually utilise. You could actually graze that, you know, with cows and put it back in the form of manure, but we tend to use it as straight green manure. Well, we've got the penetrometer in the truck, and
should we do it?
Yeah, can,
yeah,
do.
Yeah, let's
can do.
Hi, it's Jamie McCoy here. Whilst those two head off to get the penetrometer from the pickup, I thought I'd take the opportunity to advertise our Curious About Clover campaign. We have three events in Somerset, Cheshire and Cumbria in early April 2024, covering all areas of growing clover. If you're listening to this in March, there's still time to register and attend. But if you've missed the events, you'll find recordings of some of the proceedings on the campaign page. Just Google Curious About Clover. Happy Easter.
It's like a stick with a handle on that you're plunging in with a point.
It's basically a pressure gauge.
Oh, there you go. That's a better way of describing it.
It's a pressure gauge. So I've just pushed in to 200 at, what's that?
That's just over a foot, I'd say, isn't it?
Nearly, sort of 16 inches, I would say.
So it's 200 PSI.
Yeah.
And you've got to 16 inches. So that's showing that you've
There's no compaction at all at 16 inches. Oh, we're going on. So we've now pushed it into the soil up to a metre.
So we've gone down to a metre without much pressure, to be fair.
No.
Now, the end of that is what must be about 10 mil, I guess, at the thickest part.
Yeah.
So that's phenomenal. So that's telling you you've got very little compaction, if any. Where you do get compaction, and I guess when you've had a lot of water and stuff and the cows have been out and you're on after your first round, you might get a bit. What would be your action?
Yeah, because the soil is so alive, it's very, very rare that we get compaction.
Right.
So my son did his dissertation on compaction in this paddock, it actually was. And he used various things, a sward lifter and a sumo and an all-strong roller.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that penetrometer was used an awful lot. And we actually found that the all-strong roller did a really good job. We do use it and have used it, but it's not something we don't like recreational work. So the ideal is to have a living, breathing soil that looks after itself, which is pretty much what we've got.
How often would you do that?
If you've got areas that are just underperforming,
yeah.
So we'll go around the farm once a week and plate meter. So if we've got areas where we think, well, what's going on here? It's a really good look-see to say, well, is it compaction? And yeah, it'll soon tell you whether it is or not.
So that's a penetrometer. Marvellous.
That's a penetrometer.
So you're all about soils and soil microbes. I've got a soil analysis here in my hand. What does a good soil look like here? What are you looking at? On paper. So you've taken a soil sample. What are you interested in?
Yeah, so, you know, we've just been looking at NPK, you know, very basic analysis, NPK and pH. And OK, pH is vital in the whole scheme of things. But the NPK system is a pretty broken system.
Right.
And really what you need to be doing is looking at your base saturation levels. So knowing your mineral concentration that you've got on farm.
Right.
And it should be the starting point for anyone, really. And the big ones are the calcium and magnesium ratio.
Right.
We're fortunate here at Keythorpe because we're high in calcium. We are low in mag a little bit, so there are certain times, and it's usually probably third grazing round or fourth grazing round, we can go a little bit light coloured.
Yes.
So we're sort of running out of steam a bit.
Yeah.
So we do actually go on with a foliar feed then with Epsom salts and seaweed and molasses as a foliar feed.
Gosh, so that was what that toe and foot thing.
That's it. And, you know, it does. It does a job. You know, and there's more going out there now. Yeah.
So calcium's fundamental for legumes.
Yeah, definitely. If you're on a high magnesium soil, the likelihood that you're going to grow clover or legumes successfully is probably low. And maybe historically people have tried and they haven't got on well, but they've not looked, you know, at your starting point,
right,
which is the available calcium. You know, the calcium must be available to the legumes.
Well, one thing you did mention, Will, was about pH. So what's the ideal pH and how are you managing that here?
The ideal pH, well, for us, we've settled at 6.7.
Right.
Yeah. So historically, when we were conventional, we'd be putting on a tonne to 2 tonnes of lime on the whole farm, you know, every other year, you know, depending where we were, to aim to hit that 6.7. But actually, since we've been organic, the farm has just stabilised and it just sits at 6.7. And if you look at most systems, like to be at 6.7. So we've not put any lime on. for a long time. We do actually bed the cows on chalk in the cubicles.
Yep.
So that we are bringing on some available calcium year on year, but we're also exporting a hell of a lot of calcium in the form of milk. So that's working pretty well. But no, pH is absolutely critical.
I guess there's some concern with the high adoption rates of SAM3, whether people are actually going to get it quite right.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be some challenges in terms of, you know, how we get these SAM3s established. But white clover, red clover and some of the other clovers, you know, it's a bit of a no-brainer. But you have to respect the clover and what it's trying to do, and it's trying to fix nitrogen in the soil. So if you think you're going to be growing clovers and then throwing nitrogen around, they ain't going to be there.
No.
So where now?
The top of the hill, because that's a field of red clover, and you can look down and look at the farm and see my thinking spot.
You have a thinking spot.
What the F am I going to do now?
We hopped back into the pickup and headed off up the hill to the fields on the plateau.
The skylarks are going for it.
At 530 foot amongst a predominantly flat landscape, these fields sat more exposed and much wetter in the gateways.
Yeah, so this is the red clover. It'll be grass and red clover, and then we'll take it out. So it'll do 3 years. After the third cut, we'll put in a cover crop of oats and fodder radish and winter vetch, and then that'll be ploughed down. Then we'll grow fodder beet.
Right.
And then the fodder beet will come out, which is over there on that side. And then we'll go in with a whole crop. And depending on the weed burden in the fodder beet, we'll go a whole crop undersown with grass and red clover. So this was the whole crop with grass and red clover sown in 2022, in the drought year. And I was seriously worried, you know, the beginning of last year, thinking that I'm not going to have anything to feed the cows.
Yep.
But actually, a lot of the seed had laid dormant through the drought.
Right.
And came through to this spring. And, you know, this field did phenomenal. I should think this one's getting close to 14 tonnes of dry matter last year. Well, you can see the clover, there's probably mid-30s, isn't it, I would say. Maybe a bit more.
30s in terms of percent?
A percentage of clover. It's probably a bit more.
I'd
actually
say it's more,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's probably 40%.
There's a bit of space in the sward.
Yeah, which you tend to see on a red clover.
Yeah.
But this, so we've got the grazing platform in the bottom.
Yeah, as we look down into the valley,
Into the valley, and then, you know, the extremities are where we grow the silage. Yeah. We will always export, you know, all the slurry and dirty water onto the silage ground so that we're moving nutrient back to the fields where we've taken the silage from.
Yes. You did say something really interesting about pith and red clover when it comes to it being an indicator.
Yeah, so if you're growing red clover or lucerne, when you've actually got a mature plant and it's, you know, it's got a decent stem on it, if you tear that stem open, if the cell wall is very small and the pith around the outside is very narrow and it's and the stems are hollow, you're probably a bit short of calcium.
Right.
Whereas if that stem is full, you're probably okay for calcium. So it's an indicator, it's a bit of an indicator. But, you know, the main thing is to have available calcium for your clovers, which we obviously have got because it's field full
it's
of clovers.
It's got oodles of it.
You'll have to come back when the sun's shining and it actually looks a picture and not stood up here blowing a hooly and covered in muck.
So, Will, thank you for showing me all of your system there. Can you, just to finish off, just tell our listeners what your top tips might be if they wanted to start to make the most of legumes?
I've said it already, but the critical thing is to know your base saturation levels in your soil and to have free calcium in your soil, because legumes will struggle without it. So that would be the first one. I think in terms of getting the legumes established, you know, just be very mindful of what crop you're trying to establish and establish them at the right time. And then in terms of seed bed, you know, usually your legumes are small seed, so they don't want to go into the ground very deeply at all. So usually we would establish them with an iron box harrow, but we would flat roll the field before flat roll or Cambridge roll the seed bed before we put the legumes in. There is, if you've never grown legumes as well, there is a consideration to maybe inoculate the seed. Because if you haven't grown red clover before, the inoculum won't be in the soil, and certainly lucerne, if you're going to lucerne, and we've grown lucerne in the past well, but you do need to inoculate the seed at that point. In terms of the white clover inoculum, the chances are that's already in the soil. And then, you do need to roll it in really well with a flat roll.
Right. Yeah,
if you're talking about clovers, obviously if you're looking at other legumes, the peas and the beans, they still want the free calcium, but they're a bigger seed and you don't need to roll them in as tightly.
I see. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Will. That's great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good stuff.
For me, that was a really interesting couple of hours spent with Will. It highlighted to me that some of the tools that are available to us to boost dry matter output can actually hinder the functionality of the very plant that we're being incentivized to use. Approaching this with your eyes open is clearly important, and when I say that, I mean having the information to hand. Will was able to establish what was in his soil, what he needed in terms of elements, not just N, P and K, and what output the fields were giving, and just having these data to hand armed him with the control he needed. At £350 a tonne and a wallop onto your carbon footprint, we do need to be careful how we utilise nitrogen fertilisers, making sure that we optimise rather than necessarily eliminate. Knowing what is in your soil, what the plants can use, and what your slurries and manure can offer is a big step towards this. Also, if it doesn't work, it's important to establish why and then try again. For more information on nutrient management, you can download the RB209 Nutrient Management Guide from the AHDB website. You will also find further resources on growing and establishing clovers. Until next time, goodbye.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.